Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report online at schachterenergyreport.ca. He's speaking to us from Calgary. Welcome back to the show.
My pleasure to be with you again, Jim.
Did the federal budget hurt or help the petrochemical sector?
Well, the energy petrochemical sector didn't have any direct attacks by the liberals and the finance ministry. The capital gains, change, I think, really affects everybody. It may affect, spending and investment a little bit. But, we're talking, it only kicks in over 250,000. So the wealthy will get the hit, lower middle class will probably not. So that's not an issue. The big issue is government spending is just way out of control. Budget deficits are going to be big. There's no talk of moving to a balanced budget. Government employment's going to continue to rise. We'll see in 25 when we have the election if we're going to go a different path after that election. But right now, it's government wants to grow faster than the economy. And, you and I are going to be paying for it. As incomes rise, tax rates go up, you go into a higher bracket. So, the liberals seem to think that tax and spend is good, and it's the Biden agenda. And the question is, does Poilievre and Trump reigning in government cutting the size of government have investor and voter appeal going into next year?
Well, I found about the Trudeau government is their tremendous amount of spending they do on outside consultants. And as we saw with the Arrive Canada scandal, they don't really keep an eye on these consultants.
No, and number one, some of them just don't have the expertise. You wonder how the approval process for a consulting contract goes. As we saw with the all the different investigations now going on for Arrive Canada and for all the other things that have happened, it's an absolute insult to the taxpayers to allow this to continue. But they have a majority, they've got the NDP backstopping them with their majority, and they don't have it directly with liberals. But the backstop of the NDP, NDP doesn't seem to have any, moral backbone, because they're just saying, okay, give us pharmacare, or give us a little bit of dental care. The question is how good are the plans? It's good talking points for the NDP, which, if they didn't get those bones, they might disappear as a political party going into the next election.
The deputy director of the Bank of Canada said it's time to break that emergency glass, those little alarms, break glass, over Canada's declining productivity. Was anything in the federal budget done to address Canada's declining productivity?
I don't think we saw anything at all. The key thing is, the growth in our population via immigration, in the States it's called the dirty word when you say it's illegal immigration, the legal immigration, but the people who are coming in don't have the skill sets and are not being tested Do they bring in, are they accountants? Are they lawyers? Are they doctors? Are they, are they electricians? Are they, are they involved in a trade that can increase the productivity and the wealth of the country? People are coming in with very few skills, and the government's giving largesse out to them. I've heard some seniors say that the amount of money being given to new immigrants with no skills is more than people who have paid into, Canada pension forever and are senior citizens now, retired, and they feel, it's almost it's a shock to them, what's happened, versus the people who paid in and created the wealth of the country being shabbily treated versus new immigrants who get a cash in the bank, on day one based on how many members they get, room and board and, all these other things that they're getting, and, they find it objectionable.
One thing that has really held back Canada's productivity since Confederation is interprovincial trade barriers. For example, you can't get BC wine in Alberta. Alberta beer can't be sold in BC. If I'm a Nova Scotian carpenter, my carpentry certificate isn't good in the rest of the country. So goods and people aren't moving across inter or provincial borders. The last study I saw, it was costing us over $90 billion a year. Nothing done to address that either.
No, and they couldn't do that in the budget. It's more of a negotiation between the provinces and the federal government. The issue is, the cost of living in Toronto and in Vancouver and Montreal has gotten almost obscene for, people who are who have jobs that can't afford to buy a home or can't even dream of being able to afford a home in those markets. And you look at the migration into Alberta, we have the highest migration in the country. And it's a lot of it is people leaving with skills from those higher cost centers because they can afford a home. They have access to recreation. There are schools here. The healthcare problem is one right across the country with a shortage of doctors and long lineups at, emergency departments. But, the basic problems that we do have, even though we spend a lot per capita, it's the inefficiency of it that becomes an issue. And also, a lot of people who need operations are told, to see a surgeon might take a year or two if you need a hip or a knee or whatever. And if you're in massive pain, a lot of people are saying, okay, I'll go out of, if I can't do it in province, I'll go out of province and pay, or I'll go down to the States, or I'll go to UK, you've got health tourism into Thailand and India and UK now. It's a shame. It's absolutely a shame.
And in Alberta, you have Premier Danielle Smith, who now wants to throw up another barrier where if Ottawa offers any kind of program or help to a municipality or some other entity in a province, she wants them to go through a review, and so far that would be 800 pieces of offers of help and legislation. How is that going to make things more affordable in Alberta?
Well, there's some are, I can look at the positives and negatives of that, a whole issue. Yeah. The first thing I throw is, what happens in Quebec? Do the Liberals go into the bastions of Liberal support and offer it to the municipalities versus, coming to, Quebec City and doing a deal for the whole province? So I can see Quebec barfing on that issue, saying that's a no-go for them. And in Alberta, the question is, do they provide support in ridings where, they think they might have a chance to, the political shenanigans that we normally see going on where you buy votes, it's what's going on with Biden. He's buying the votes of people in debt from their university, expenses with write-offs of debt. The Liberals know this divide and conquer and buying off votes. And, of course, they need to, because right now the politics look like they won't win the next election, even with NDP support. So, I think that, you could argue that, a city that needs a specific help on a specific issue, you know, be it roads, be it more schools, be it more hospitals, be it, you know, funding for, you know, if there's going to be an Olympics or, you know, or you know, games, you know, for Commonwealth Games or something, you'd think that the, you know, an individual there, but you also think that the provinces should be involved as well, because they're going to be asked to put to write a check as well. So I can see both sides of the issue, but I can see that, you know, in Alberta, the intrusion on specific issues bothers the premier and bothers the UCP, and they're just saying, look, this, you know, there's no fairness to this, and there's win and lose, but we've got to be involved.
We'll have more with Joseph Schachter right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Joseph Schachter. Joseph, what would be the real price of crude if we didn't have all of these problems in the Middle East and Russia versus Ukraine?
Yeah, the price of crude is, you know, $82.60. It was up at $88, if you recall, just a short while ago. But we've had in the last few weeks proof of demand weakening and inventories building. For example, the EIA, you know, the Energy Information Administration, the U.S. government, the weekly report for the petroleum balance sheet showed a 10 million barrel increase for total stocks, excluding the SPR, and a build in commercial stocks. And inventories now in the U.S. on a total stocks basis are now 3.3 million barrels ahead of last year. So there's a build in inventory coming because demand is weakening, and we're in the shoulder season. We've talked before that during the shoulder season of spring and fall, demand falls by 2 to 2.5 million versus the average for the year, which might be 102 million. And so that softness is there. We know China's data has been very weak on the consumer side, you know, they're trying all kinds of things to stimulate their economy, but unsuccessfully so far. So if the two biggest economies, the U.S. and China, are not seeing demand growth and seeing supplies increase and inventories building in both the, you know, the commercial stocks and in the, you know, the strategic petroleum reserves, that I think is pushing prices down. You asked about the premium for the war premium. I think it was at the high when we were 88. I think we were $15 to $18 of premium there. I think now we've knocked off a little bit, $4 or $5. I think we're going down below 80. I even believe we're going to be below 75 sometime in May, and then we'll see where supply and demand are. I think we're going to see the price pick up in the fourth quarter because I think supply and demand will be in balance then. If we see you know, recovery in the China economy by that time, then we could see $90 plus WTI. But right now, I think there's a good shot that we could take off another $7, $8, maybe even more than that. If we see very weak demand and we see the war premium shrink even more, we could even bust 70 for a short period of time. But I think, as I said just a minute or two ago, I think by the fourth quarter, $90 handle is what we'll be looking at. So the question is, does the market react and go down with the price of oil going down in the near term, or does it start looking out towards the winter 24-25 and say we're going to see $90 handle the stocks don't weaken? If you break down the stock groups between oil, natural gas, and energy service, the oil stocks have been very robust because of the price rise to $88. If we do see the price of oil break 80 and then 75, that's where the damage on the downside will come, where the price erosion will come. And on the natural gas stocks, they're weak. Some of them are near their 52-week lows. They're going to probably see a little more softness, but not much downside because they haven't performed in line with the oils because the price of natural gas hasn't done anything. And on the service stocks, some have done well. Some have been very poor because of drilling activity being weak. So there's some value there. But again, if we do see a erosion in the oily names and the Baker Hughes statistics are weak, then I think we're going to see even they drift off. And my guess is we're going to see a buying opportunity sometime in the next few months, a low-risk one. But right now, I would be more cautious. As you know, there's been times when I've been a table-pounding buyer of the sector, and other times I've been more cautious. This is one of those caution periods.
What kind of will there be any difference in prices once the Trans Mountain Pipeline finishes its doubling completion and starts shipping oil off to Asia?
Well, the pipeline is taking oil in April and May, and the shipments should start shortly. And the key thing that we're finding is that the buyers are in California because they can't get heavy crude for their refineries because the California government has slowed down the activity level to drill for heavy oil in the state. And so they're going to be ones who buy some of our Canadian oil. And then there will be, of course, shipments into Asia, and we're seeing some contracts being signed and announcements being made, and that will help. Differentials were $15, $16 between, they were, in other words, the price for WCS, was below, the WTI price by that amount, and now that's shrunk to about $12 or so. So there is a better value for Canadian producers. And the big thing, of course, is look at the Canadian dollar, 1.37, 1.38, conversion. And that gives the industry a very, very healthy price on the liquid side, which is helping the industry do well. And, if you drive around by shopping centers or you go into restaurants, they're all pretty busy now, for the most part, simply because the industry is doing well, and the people are being hired, and there's people getting bonuses, and so there's a wealth effect, because of the U.S. Dollar Canadian dollar exchange rate for liquids. When I go see companies that are natural gas focused, they're a little more humble. I met with one company today, and they're just trying to make sure the cash flow coming in meets their G&A and their CapEx. They don't see building their, building volumes very much. They think even in Q2, Q3, volumes might come in lower than Q1. These sloppy prices of $1.70 really don't make much money for companies. They really need $2.50 AECO. And then, of course, once we start seeing, more than LNG Canada on stream, then maybe we'll start seeing, in 27, 28, we might be looking at $3 plus for AECO. Winter pricing, you can hedge some for $3 handle. But again, we need that on a sustainable year-round basis. There is volatility, and historically, when you get into the spring, summer, we can get sub-pricing below $1 on MCF. This year, maybe not so, because TransCanada doesn't have any major maintenance issues, so they won't be shutting in a large part of the system, so we may not see those really egregiously low negative rate of return pricing that we've seen in the past.
Are EVs just a fad that's fading, or will electric vehicles eat into the crude oil market?
Well, EVs, the big issue for them is electricity. And, how are you going to create it? Are you going to do the small modular nuclear plants? Are you going to burn more coal like India and China are doing to then have an EV industry? Or are you going to use natural gas? Then you take into account all of the data centers and how much more power they're going to need electricity-wise. We have to find a reasonable solution to provide the electricity that we need for day-to-day use, for EV use and for data center and all the, the AI world that we're going into. And to me, the industry is not, building up the capacity that's going to be needed. And so, the question is, do we reverse, the standards in Canada and the States, or, U.S. does it and we follow, or do we start allowing more cogen with natural gas? The small modular nuclear plants make sense. Solar renewables, have really not done the job. And of course, you have cloudy skies or snow on the solar panels, it just, you know, it makes it tough for parts of the year. And remember, wind last year in Europe wasn't very helpful. So, it really is not the sustainable provider of electricity that we need. And, cogen facilities can be that way with natural gas. And yet, the government in Ottawa, is anti-energy, anti-oil, anti-natural gas, and they're pro-carbon taxes, and yet they don't have an answer to solve the problem of how do we get more electricity and how do we build it. You know, there's no more rivers to dam and destroy the environment in Labrador for Quebec. So, to find a solution is not the easiest. And Quebec has lost auto plants because they and battery plants for EVs because they just don't have the electricity for these industry and the potential large number of jobs that they would create.
British Columbia, which relies almost 100% on hydro, will have to import power starting next year because of low snowpacks and low rainfall.
Yeah, we have the same thing in Calgary. In Alberta, we don't have enough water in many of the rivers. And if we have a fire season again like we had last year, that's going to be disruptive. There is an environmental crisis here, but the way the government is approaching it, they're not helping. They're probably harming it more than helping. As you said, BC said, okay, all the new new LNG plants are going to use, electricity from hydro. And as you just mentioned, it ain't there. So, what are they going to do? Are they going to change the rules and say, you can use your own natural gas to create the electricity and backtrack? Or, is Quebec going to backtrack on their natural gas? And yet they've just opened a new plant, or a plant that was shuttered, they reopened it, it's natural gas, and it's taking gas from Western Canada and Appalachia. So, even Quebec, which, is so anti, fossil fuels, has realized, if you don't have air conditioning in the summer and heat ability to heat homes in the winter, where's your political voting base?
I always wondered, considering all the sunshine that Alberta gets, all of Canada gets in the summertime because we're a northern latitude, or why not have a law that says you have to put solar cells on the south side of every new building? I mean, at least in the summer, that would help with your air conditioning, wouldn't it?
It would, and on houses and everything, it could make if people have storage capability, then it would help the individuals, more than just during those sunny periods. You can't mandate it. You can't order people to do it. You've got to incentivize that, and the economics have to be there. And if the economics aren't there, it's not going to happen. And so, right now you don't really see a big push saying, put solar on your roof because you'll save money. The cost of installing, the cost of solar, the panels are cheap because China's selling them at a loss to the world so they can destroy all the competition. But the reality is, when it comes to a dollar and cents economic decision, it doesn't make sense at this time.
Joseph, anything else we should be keeping a close eye on right now?
Yeah, I'm getting more and more perturbed and worried about the general stock market valuations. We've had, a massive run since the fall, from, 32,000 on the Dow to 39,900, almost 40,000. We're backed off a little bit here, but I think there's a chance of a 15-20% severe general market correction for two reasons. Number one, interest rates have gone up. The 10-year U.S. yield is 4.60. It could easily run to 5%. There's issues with the bid-to-cover ratio. The inflation data has been hotter. Now you've got people saying there may not even be any cuts in rates in the Fed funds rate this year. So you've got, concern that rates could go higher, and therefore what you'll pay for earnings will come down. And the second part of that then becomes earnings. And if earnings disappoint, and we've seen a number of companies already report in the banking sector that were disappointing, there's a of course, the big amount of Q1 reporting is going to be the next, 30 to 45 days. And if there are a disproportionate number of negative comparisons or guidance that's negative, that could be the reason for to take away the euphoria and put a little fear into the market. And the big problem is there's less than 2% cash on the sidelines. When you're at market bottoms, when there's a lot of fear, that number can be 8% or 10% cash. So there's very little fuel to drive markets higher, and that to me is a problem. So between the two of them, of rising rates and potential concerns on the earnings front, I think people should be somewhat defensive, have some cash reserves to take advantage of it. If you've got some stellar profits in AI or oily names, take them, and build up some defensive posture. And if you're using margin, get the hell out, because if the market goes against you, that's a double whammy. Both the value of your stocks goes down, but then the margin, becomes more of an issue, and you get a two-for-one kick in the ass. And so I think people should be very careful that they don't, succumb to a severe rout in their net worth if we do see that this market correct. And by the time you and I talk next month, I think we'll find out if this is just going to be a little pain or a lot of pain. And we've had a little pain during the month of April since our last conversation, but I think by the time we talk next time at the end of May, it'll be more severe pain. And so, again, forewarned.
Sell before May and go away.
Yeah, they always say sell in May and go away, and this time it's 1 month early. Yeah, I agree.
Joseph, thank you so much for chatting with us.
My pleasure as always, Jim.
My guest has been Joseph Schachter, founder of the Schachter Energy Report, online at schachterenergyreport.ca. He was speaking to us from Calgary. If you have any questions for Joseph or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.